This is how we do it.
This is how we do it.
La 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 la. This is how we do it. It's Friday night.
All right, look, Jake, forget about looking cool. I mean, let's concentrate on acting cool.
Don't talk to me about cool, Master William.
And remember, Homecorder tapes playing your VHS VCR.
Panasonic, just slightly ahead of our time.
Interest rates are going up.
This is a special report from ABC News.
I'm Pete Jennings at ABC News headquarters. Let's immediately go to a picture in Los Angeles. We're interrupting 2020 so that the rest of you around the country can see this quite extraordinary scene unfold on one of the freeways in the Los Angeles area. We believe at the moment it is 91 West, headed towards Cerritos. Down there on the ground is a white Ford Bronco. It's just in the left of your picture, in the center, going from right to left. And it is not being chased, but it is being accompanied by a real phalanx of police cars on the ground, police helicopters in the air, and obviously the ABC News helicopter in the air as well. But this has been going on for some time now. Police believe they have located O.J. Simpson, wanted on two counts of murder, in this white Bronco going somewhere. Now, as has been the case all week, there have been a variety of reports as to what has transpired in the vehicle, as to how they find him. One report says they tracked him through cellular telephone calls made from the vehicle. One other report has it that he is in the back seat holding a gun to his head.
Just let me get to my house.
Please. Okay, we're going to do that.
I swear to you, I'll give you what. I'll give you my whole body.
Okay.
I just need to get to my house.
Okay.
We're
going
to
do that. Just throw the gun out the window.
I can't do that.
We're not going to bother you. We're going to let you go up there. Just throw it out the window, please. You're scaring everybody. OJ, you there?
This is for me. This is not to keep you guys away from me. This
I know
for
that.
Me.
Nobody's going to hurt
this
you.
This is for me.
Okay, it's for you. I know that, but do it
this
for you.
This is for me, for me.
I know
all.
That. I know that, but do it for the kids, too, will you?
Yeah.
Think of your kids.
Yeah.
Please, just toss it out. You're scaring everybody, man.
I'm not going to hurt anybody.
I know you're not going to hurt anybody.
I need
but
it for me.
I know you're not, man.
I'm just going to go with me.
Please, you're scaring everybody, though. You're scared.
Just tell them I'm all sorry. You can tell them later on today and tomorrow that I was sorry and that I'm sorry that I did this to the police department.
Listen, I think you should tell them yourself.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to have to tell your kids that. Your kids need you.
I've already said goodbye to my kids.
Listen, no, we're not going to say goodbye to your kids.
Oh,
you're going to see them again. You want to see them again. Please, you're scaring us. You're scaring them. Please, man.
Hey, you've been a good guy, too, man.
Thanks,
I know you're doing your job. You went
I appreciate
honest with me right
that.
From the beginning, just saying you're doing your job.
Listen.
I know you do a good job.
Okay, thank you. But there's a lot of people that love you. Don't throw it all away. Don't throw it all away.
I can't take this.
Oh, yes, you can. Yes, you can.
I can't.
Don't do it, OJ. It's going to work itself out.
But the real injustice is the way police officers view blacks in Los Angeles, even after the riots, even after the Christopher Commission. The LAPD culture has not changed. You have to understand that this is a city where four white police
went down into the county court's records, found file after file on Detective Mark Furman. Guy's worse than I remembered. Actually sued the city.
He's a plaintiff?
Hang on, that's not the mind-blowing part. He sued the city basically claiming that his duties as an LAPD officer made him into a bigot.
What?
Serving as a cop gave him violent fantasies.
Come on.
He describes beating up and attacking black people.
Okay, let me get this straight. You're saying that the homicide detective that discovered all the evidence on O.J. Simpson hates black people?
The cop who found the glove at Rockingham.
This is a gift. Imagine. That O.J. Simpson was set up by the cops because he was a black man. And because the LAPD has a systemic racism problem.
Thanks for taking the time to see me.
Now, you're New York Magazine or New Yorker?
New Yorker.
New Yorker.
Alan Dershowitz told me to look you up.
Ah.
I'm doing a piece on cash for trash stories. Witnesses selling their testimony. The O.J. Simpson trial seemed like
No, it's inconsequential. It's window dressing. It's not the best use of your time for me.
It's the story I'm out here to cover.
Well, I know it is, but wouldn't you rather ask me why a man like me would take a case like this? You might be surprised.
I might be surprised if I'm surprised. Okay. Tell me.
Because of its far-reaching implications. I've never seen anything like it. And I couldn't stand by and let it happen. Please.
Let what happen exactly?
The systematic railroading of O.J. Simpson by a racist LAPD because he is a black man.
Wait, what?
The LAPD history is a shameful history, and everybody knows it. It's no secret. And this cop, Mark Furman, who discovered everything, he's an admitted racist. Any evidence he touches is questionable.
So I want to be clear. You're saying this policeman set up O.J. Simpson?
Maybe. Maybe Mark Furman, maybe others, in a conspiracy.
Wait. So all the blood evidence, somehow these cops, a cabal of racist police officers, planted it. From the murder scene to the Bronco to Rockingham?
Who else could have? Take a step back. I mean, doesn't it seem odd that this glove just happened to be a Rockingham at the same time that Detective Furman just happened to find it?
It isn't odd if Simpson dropped it after he climbed the wall to avoid being seen by the limo driver.
Jeff, you look like a smart kid. Don't rush to judgment. We will show that it's impossible for a black man to get a fair shake with the LAPD. We will prove this.
So you're gonna say this case is all about race?
Yes, because it is. I'm just simply shedding a light on it.
Do you use the word nigger in describing people?
Presently.
Yes. Oh.
No, sir.
Have you used that word in the past 10 years?
Not that I recall, no.
You mean if you called someone a nigger, you have forgotten it?
I'm not sure I can answer that question the way you phrase it, sir.
You have difficulty understanding the question. I'll rephrase it.
Yes.
I want you to assume that perhaps at some time since 1985 or 6, you addressed a member of the African-American race as a nigger. Is it possible that you have forgotten that act on your part?
No, it's not possible.
Are you therefore saying that you have not used that word in the past 10 years, Detective Furman?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And you say on your oath that you have not addressed any black person as a nigger or spoken about black people as niggers in the past 10 years, Detective Furman.
That's what I'm saying, sir.
So that anyone who comes to this court and quotes you as using that word in dealing with African Americans would be a liar, would they not, Detective Furman?
Yes, they would.
All of them, correct?
All of them.
All right. Thank
you. Detective Furman, would you please resume the witness stand? All right, good afternoon, Detective.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
You're reminded, sir, that you are still under oath. Mr. Ullman, you may proceed.
Detective Furman, was the testimony that you gave in this case completely truthful?
I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Have you ever falsified a police report?
I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Is it your intention to assert your Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to all questions that I ask you?
Yes.
I only have one other question.
What was that, Mr. Ullman?
Detective Furman, did you plant or manufacture any evidence in this case?
I assert my Fifth Amendment privilege.
Mr. Simpson, would you please stand and face the jury? Mrs. Robertson.
Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, in the matter of the people of the state of California versus Orenthal James Simpson, case number BA097211. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is March 22nd, and this is the final installment in the Thaddeus Russell versus Academic Conformism miniseries. Today's show focuses on listener questions, and oh, I wish we get some more of them. I even wanted to do like a speed round where we would try to do all the questions that everybody submitted, and Thad would have 2 minutes to deal with each one the best he could in that time frame. Unfortunately, we only got to a handful. There's lots of side topics, but I was happy with how the show went. I actually learned quite a bit about the politics and the obstructive forces in higher education, really kind of lurking in the shadows, but still responsible for so many of the problems we see in academia today. So a couple of production notes before we start. First of all, I thought about cutting that whole intro out of the show because it's a little bit misleading. We only wind up talking about the OJ thing for 4 minutes. And what I was suggesting there, not a controversial suggestion, but it was the race card that quote-unquote exonerated OJ Simpson. And we've explored this subject matter before in a couple other shows that are worth checking out. There's a Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass called The World's Most Dangerous Groups that we recorded after we saw the Straight Outta Compton movie, talking about some of the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the early 90s. And Thad and I actually did a show on the movie Straight Outta Compton as well, where we explore some of the same topics, but from different angles. And, you know, I'm just really interested in that place and time. And you know, even when I just have the most meager excuse for opening the show with a sweet 10-minute OJ montage, I'm probably going to jump on it, quite frankly. I mean, it is my show. I could open every podcast with a 10-minute OJ trial drama montage. And it might be a little bit hard at times to tie that to the rest of the content, but it worked here. I'm not going to say there wasn't some sunken cost fallacy because it was a considerable amount of work to find those clips and put them in that order. Some come from real life. Some come from the TV show. It was an exciting time in Los Angeles. So Thad and I talk about it a little, and it provides a transition into some of our other subjects today. So that's production note one. Misleading intro. You would think the show would be entirely about the O.J. Simpson trial, something that I am currently obsessed with. I've been watching the Netflix The People versus O.J. Simpson, and this has led me in my free time to actually going back and watching some of the trial footage just to compare the television show to real life, which is always such a cool experience when, you know, you lived through such a big event and you can sit there and can nudge the person next to you like, I remember when this happened. I was a kid. I remember where I was. Whatever. It's neat. There is something you can find on YouTube. It was a pay-per-view special. You just put into YouTube O.J. Simpson, the interview, full 1996. Those are the search terms. That's the title. So this was like a special presentation that O.J. did where he tells his side of the story and you get to tour the grounds at Rockingham, which was part of the crime scene. Fascinating stuff. My friend John told me about this, I think, last week when I was telling him how excited I was about The People versus O.J. Simpson. He said, when you watch this OJ special, this pay-per-view thing that OJ did, you might start to question what you have believed for 20 years. And I did. So, you know, one of the problems that I had, one of the problems that a lot of people had, I guess, when this whole trial was taking place, or even looking back at the trial, and the television show deals with this a little bit too, is like no other suspects ever entered into the picture. They floated a few things about maybe it was cocaine related. Nicole Simpson had some strange ties, allegedly, to drug dealers. But on the other hand, there's never really a motive established for OJ. It suggested that it was a kind of crime of passion driven by jealousy. But if you look at things like the gloves and the knit cap and the flight to Chicago immediately after the murders took place, it seems like this crime was premeditated. And, you know, not for nothing, but less than 2 weeks after this murder happened, he's driving around in the Bronco with AC there and he's got a gun. He surely had that gun the night of the murder. So, you know, why make an unnecessary mess? This isn't the Dark Knight. He's not the Joker. And to do all this like right before you have to catch a flight to Chicago, I mean, I know this was like pre-TSA, but flying is stressful enough. like committing a murder and then cleaning up a murder and, you know, then getting to the airport on time. It just seems like a really overwhelming night to me. But I have less experience traveling than OJ, so maybe flying seems like a bigger deal to me. It's more of a stressful event. And maybe it was the murder that he underestimated. He didn't know that would be such a big deal because he's never done that before. These are just, you know, things to think about. But the most important thing is that the racist legacy of the LAPD was used against the prosecution very, very successfully in this case. And it's a, it just makes for a fascinating story. So I highly recommend watching The People versus O.J. Simpson. And there's a documentary, O.J. Simpson Made in America, that was nominated for an Academy Award. I've been meaning to check that out as well. And I probably will because I'm on a real O.J. kick right now. I'm calling it my juice cleanse, right? Steve, edit that out. Anyway, so that's production note number one. Production note number two, we had a little bit of difficulty with Thad's audio. We spent like a good 20 minutes before we started recording trying to fix this problem. And then eventually, because time was ticking away, I said I would just work on it in post, and I did the best I could with it. I don't know how to describe it. It was kind of like Thad had an angry tree frog sitting in his lap. And every time he said something, this little chirpy tree frog would become agitated and start, you know, making frog sounds. So I worked on this audio quite a bit. I had to isolate the chirps and figure out what the frequency was, and then I tried to notch them out using an equalizer. Now, I didn't do this to my voice, just Thad's voice, but there's times where Thad is talking and I'm going, yeah, yeah, oh yeah, I agree, And you'll just hear it'll sound kind of like I'm talking through a pillow after it was re-rendered with those frequencies notched out. So if you're curious about that, that's why, and that's a look behind the scenes of not planning properly for production and reassuring yourself you can fix things in post-production. I definitely think it's listenable. Thad is starting his own podcast, so he will have better recording equipment in the future, and we will be having more conversations like these. So thanks so much to everybody who offered really positive feedback about these conversations, and thank you to everybody who submitted questions for this episode. I'm sorry we did not get to more of them, but like I said, we will have another chance in the future. All right, everybody, that's it. Again, please stay tuned. At the very end of the show, I will have an important and exciting announcement. You don't want to miss that. And here we go, Q&A with Thaddeus Russell.
Once upon a time in 94, Montel made no money and life show us slow. And all they said was 6'8 he stood, and people thought the music that he made was good. They lived the DJ and Paul was his name. He came up to money, this is what he said: you and OG are gonna make some cash, sell a million records and we're making the dash. Oh, I'm buzzing the club.
This is how we do it.
Sounds like nobody does.
Thaddeus, welcome back to the show.
Hey.
All right, so this is our third and final installment, and I really wanted to focus in this episode on listener questions. One quick thing that I really just feel compelled to ask you about. I started watching The People versus O.J. Simpson last night. Have you seen that?
No, I've heard a whole lot about it, but I haven't.
What was your life like when that happened? I was like 16 years old, and I was 18, and I was a freshman in college when the whole thing wrapped up. But you were probably in your mid-20s, right? And you were in that area. What was that like for you? What did you make of it then?
No, I was in New York. I was in graduate school at Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a good question, actually. And I've been thinking about it a lot since there's been this renewed interest in OJ.
Yeah.
Because that was actually the beginning of one change of mind that I had about politics and race in particular. So I was obsessed with the trial.
Yeah.
In New York City, in Manhattan, going to Columbia, graduate school, second or third year in grad school, I think. What year was it?
94, it started.
I would have been 28. Yeah, I was obsessed with it. I watched pretty much all of it on TV because I was in grad school, so I could, you know. You have a lot of time on your hands when you're in grad school. And it was fascinating. I loved it. Great drama. Also learning a lot about the legal system through doing that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, like many or most people, it was pretty clear to me that he did it. And when they announced the verdict, I think I threw something. I think it was like something fairly big. I don't know, I threw something across the room because I was outraged.
Yeah, it's interesting. I lived downstairs. Yeah, I was in the dorms. I was a freshman in college when they read the verdict. I lived downstairs from the basketball team. Sounds like a made up story. I lived downstairs from the basketball team, and what they threw was a party. Right. Yeah. They almost came through the floor. And I wondered if that was kind of like, if you looked at the first half of the 1990s in Los Angeles, and certainly going back to the 80s, like the stuff we talked about with the LAPD program and, you know, the NWA and rap groups like that talked about happening at that time. That's how a lot of people outside of that area learned what was going on. It seemed like the OJ thing seemed to be a kind of corrective to an observer, to like the Rodney King and the LA riots and the police abuse going back into the 1980s. And it seemed like a kind of false victory that kind of maybe undermined some of the goals of social justice, even though it wasn't really called that then, and that I do of anyway. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right, mostly. I, like a lot of people, especially white people, had that reaction. I thought it was... Well, I don't even think I was clued into what it meant politically and in terms of social justice, in part because, you know, I never was in LA before that. I had never lived in LA. I was a Bay Area kid, so we shunned LA. We thought LA was inferior, so we didn't go there. I was in LA once for a week my entire life at that point.
Right. And
never didn't know anything about it really. Although I guess that's post NWA, so I didn't know about that. I was aware of police brutality. I wasn't terribly political, and you know, I was a solid leftist then I thought it was an outrage. I was very upset, and then I remember the word for me was disappointed in Black people's response to it.
Sure.
And I was then becoming friends with a guy who's now a sociology professor at Wesleyan, I think I've mentioned on the show maybe, whose name is Jonathan Cutler. Have I talked about Jonathan Cutler on here?
The name sounds familiar. Yeah,
he had a lot of the ideas that I now have. We met by chance. He was a grad student then at CUNY, and we worked on this. We were hired to do this project together just by luck. And it just, I was clearly like, I was frustrated with the left and politics that I was surrounded by, and the people in the left in particular, you know, being in Manhattan, having grown up in Berkeley and having gone to Antioch and all that. But I couldn't make sense of it. You know?
Right.
And he sort of basically just started asking questions, and just from doing that and making suggestions, you know, he kind of led me to where I am now. I mean, he sort of started it at least.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then I've been fleshing it out and adding a great deal of detail to all that since then. But kind of the basic ideas, he kind of opened the door for me. And I don't even know, it's never clear to me how he came to these ideas, because he was trained at CUNY, which is in the sociology department, which is just as hard left as you can get. Although there was a somewhat iconoclastic leftist professor there who was his mentor, whose name is Stanley Aronowitz,
mm-hmm.
who people should pay attention to if they're not on the left. I mean, like libertarians especially, because if there is such a thing as a libertarian socialist, he's it. And in other words, he was aware of statism. He had an analysis of the state. He called himself an anti-statist. His words were council communist, meaning the idea that, you know, the workers should take control of the means of production and run the industries themselves, right?
Yeah.
Without the state. And so, you know, I've talked about how I am no fan of that model either, but at least, unlike the vast majority of leftists, he had an analysis of the state and was critical of it, and
right.
was critical of statism and understood it, right? Most people on the left aren't even aware. I'm not sure if I told you this, but like my mother, radical socialist for much of her life, you know, just as of like a year ago, I brought this up and she seemed unaware of it, you know, that laws are actually enforced by the threat of violence.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she didn't even know that. She was like, well, no, that's not true. I said, yeah, no, Mom, it really is true. Even like ticket, you know, even like traffic tickets. If you don't pay your traffic ticket, yeah, they send you a notice and they send you a notice and they send you a notice. And she said, yeah, that's all they do. And I said, no. And then if you keep not sending in your fine, the cops come to your door with guns, right?
Or that happens when you get pulled over. It's happened to me before. I didn't even know my license was suspended in a state. I got pulled over and they kidnapped me effectively for that in 2008. So did she surrender to that idea eventually and accept it?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. But it was hard for her. I could see it was emotionally. it was, I think she was embarrassed that she didn't know that. And, but I don't really blame her because that's never brought up.
Sure.
And I didn't know it. I didn't know it until I was in my 30s, probably, having been a political person for a long time. Well, the woman, what was her name? Corinne Gaines in Maryland, who was killed by the SWAT team, right?
Yeah.
It all started from traffic fines, traffic tickets, right? Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
Why was the SWAT team at her door with guns, with, you know, assault rifles? Yeah, because she didn't pay her traffic fine. So,
Well, it sounds like there's some intellectual, or quite a bit of intellectual honesty there, because I've posed that same problem to lots of people in my life. And there was never any rethinking where they said, oh, no, yeah, you're right. It is violence. It is violence. I mean, even though it's so clear when you think about it and you can explain it like step by step, people would leave clouds of dust running away from those conversations. Yeah. You know,
and it's not like no leftists have ever thought of this. Right. I mean, Max Weber is the one who basically came up with the concept.
Right.
You know, the state is the legitimate monopoly on violence. And then, of course, Marxists have been very aware of it, you know, and unapologetic about it, right? That's the difference. At least Marxists understand that and are not afraid to talk about it, right? They say, yeah, no, we're going to use violence. In fact, there was a hilarious tweet last night from, you know, the Chop Out Trap House podcast.
No, I don't.
It's like the hottest thing among, like, Bernie bros and, like, aggro male socialists. They love it. It's huge. So it's like it got reviewed on the New Yorker and stuff. It's a big deal. Three dudes in Brooklyn who, I don't know. I can't even. It's hard to listen to for 5 minutes. But
I love this idea. What's it called again? I'm going to put it on a post-it note.
Chapo, like El Chapo, the drug dealer. Yeah. CHPO.
Yeah.
Trap, like drug house, trap house, Chapo, Chapo.
I love it.
Yeah, it's a great name, and it's a great idea. I mean, you know, they're funny, I guess. I mean, if you have a particular sense of humor. It's like Jon Stewart, but communist and meaner. they're meaner. But anyway, they're huge. They're a big deal. They're a big deal on the left. The left loves them, especially guys. It's a masculine. It's also like unapologetically masculine, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Bernie bro thing.
Interesting.
So anyway, last night, one of those guys on Twitter said, everyone should go look at this. It's really funny. There's a, I think it's a libertarian meme. It's like the, it's like an illustration of, on the top panel is, it says capitalism, unequal distribution of wealth, right? And the bottom panel, and it's like, there's a guy holding a bag
money bag. Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Bottom panel is two cops holding guns to his head. It says socialism, something is terrible too, or something, you know.
Equal. Yeah.
And the guy, and the Chapo Trap House guy says, I don't know. The guys with the guns look pretty happy to me.
That shouldn't be funny, but it is to me.
Right? So at least right. Marxists, and these guys are Marxists.
Right.
Like unapologetic, like loud Marxists. And, you know, they understand it and they get it. But most people who are not sort of the hard left don't get it. It's amazing. Like, you just don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if quite a few political scientists don't actually know that you go to that it's there will be violence, or they don't even if they will know that you will go to prison at the point of a gun,
right?
They don't think of that as violence, right? Which is remarkable. That's probably the way they probably think of certain acts of war, as not violence like other kinds of violence. If they saw me punching someone in the face on the street, horrified, they'd be horrified. But, you know, I think that taking someone to a cage when you have a gun and they don't, and locking them in that cage,
yeah,
for them isn't violence, is less, certainly less horrifying. And it's a different kind of violence. It's a lesser, for them, there would be a lesser form of violence. Think about that. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people, liberals in particular. Liberals are especially bad on this. And one of the great examples, one of the most hilarious examples, is Sally Cohn.
Yep.
Yeah, this was like a year or two ago, and I forget what it was about. There was some debate about taxes, I think, and someone said somewhere, some conservative or somebody, some Republican said this. You know, I said, well, it's about forcing people at the point of a gun, or something about using violence to make us pay taxes, whatever. You know.
Yeah.
And she just went on Twitter, and I think she was even on CNN saying, "What? This is absurd. Like, no one forces you to pay taxes." She said that. I mean, she said, no one forces you to pay tax. There's no violence involved. I mean, she really never processed that. right? That what law means.
Well, I mean, no one holds a gun to my head while I go through all the forms on H&RBlock.com. The guns just come out if I don't. So if she's, you know, she gleefully pays whatever taxes. I mean, you know, unless she's a hypocrite and she's got like offshore accounts, like a lot of these people in Hollywood do, maybe. But she's probably very invested in that idea for the greater good.
Here's what it is.
Yeah.
It's if you have not merged your identity with the nation state,
mm-hmm.
then you know that it's violence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If you have merged your identity with the nation state, I am America and America is me, and cops may make mistakes and do terrible things, but basically we're on the same team, then it would never occur. Why would it occur to you that it's violence? Right.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't know if they'd say America. I mean, this might sound nitpicky, but like America versus merging your identity with the government. It seems like a lot of people on the right merge their identity with this idea of America, and people on the left, from what I understand, merge their identity directly with the government. You know, and I think there's a difference, right?
Okay, so first of all, we have to differentiate between left and liberals here, right? So
the Chapo
Trap House guys don't do that, you know, and they get it that it's violence and they're not about being Americans at all. And,
exactly, yeah.
Right, but liberals, you know, like Sally Cohn, Democratic Party, The Nation, even a lot of people at The Nation magazine, that crowd, you know, basically MSNBC watchers. I mean, no, they completely identify not just with the government. They very much identify with the government, right? But they also identify with America. And this has been shown with Trump. I mean, this is one of the things that Trump has shown, is that these people are, you know, you could call it patriotic, but it's, you know, their status, their nation status. So they think that America is a good thing. American exceptionalism, it's a liberal concept.
Yeah, sure.
First of all, right? I mean, so that they're the ones who came up with the idea that we are great and awesome, and therefore we should make everyone else be just like us, great and awesome. So there's a deep merger of their identity with the nation, which is of course an idea, right? A nation is an idea,
yeah.
Concept. America is a concept, and then the state is the apparatus, right?
Is the word liberal useful anymore when describing the left, considering what it means? Like, I don't think the word conservative is useful either. Like, as Richard Spencer said, what did they conserve? You know, what were they? What did they set out to? Like, it wasn't economic. Oh, yeah. It wasn't social. And liberal, you know, meaning free, these don't seem like the right words to describe these two prevailing political phenomena in the United States.
They're the only liberal. I mean, well, you know, I mean, liberal, the only liberals in the classical sense around are libertarians.
Exactly. All right. So let's dig into some of these questions from the audience. The first one comes from Peter. And his question was, is intellectual conformism a purely academic problem, or does it extend into other social intellectual spheres? How do we actively combat it? And what does Thad plan to do to make sure the same problem doesn't evolve at Renegade? To that, Philip adds, great question. Maybe Renegade can somehow incentivize intellectual diversity.
What was the first part of the question? It was about being...
Is intellectual conformism among academics a purely academic problem, or does it extend into other social intellectual spheres?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, it extends everywhere, even among libertarians, right?
Absolutely. In fact,
you admitted, you've acknowledged that. Although, as I think I said when we talked about that, I think libertarians, not because they're just better people or better intellectuals, are forced to be better intellectuals because they're always in the minority. And so those who are in the minority must confront antagonistic ideas head on. They have no choice. Whereas, you know, if you control most of the media, all of the universities, and almost all of the civil service,
yeah,
you know,
right,
you can brush people off when they bring up some fundamental question about your ideas, right? I mean, you can either just totally ignore them because they pose no real threat since you have all that power,
absolutely,
or you can dismiss them, you know, by calling them a racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, which used to be, which is relatively new, because it used to just be, I've noticed this transition just in my interactions. It used to be, who do you think you are? You know, everyone powerful is on my side. Do you think there's some sense that the people who have this uniformity, be it in academia, in the media, they know they're losing ground? That's something that's very palpable now?
Starting to see it. Yeah. So let's see. Let me take Philip's question in different pieces, though. I mean, I think, so first of all, yeah, obviously it's a problem everywhere, although how to confront that, how to change that. Now, let me say this, and I'm not sure I've ever said this. I complain about intellectual conformism every single day. It's kind of, you know, almost my brand in a way at this point. But I am pretty convinced that now there is less intellectual conformity, at least in American culture, than ever before. So I think it's hard. It'd be hard to argue against that proposition. For mostly because of technology, and the combination of technology that's available, and the, despite what the left will tell you, the fact that poor people are wealthier than ever before in this country. Mm-hmm. They're still poor relative to other Americans, but poor people now can get on Twitter and communicate their ideas to anyone in the whole wide world. And not just that, many, many of them are communicating their ideas to tens or hundreds of thousands of people because they happen to be smart and good at it. Mm-hmm. People who had nothing when they started Twitter, no money at all, no nothing. And people, you know, there's all these studies about and claims about the internet and, you know, causing the siloing of people and that there's less talking to each other. I think it's just the opposite. I understand, sure, I get it, that you curate your Twitter feed and your Facebook feed, you know, and many people just funnel people who agree with them into there.
Yeah, and their algorithms do that too. That's part of the problem.
But if you haven't lived in the past, I sort of understand why you don't get it. But if you know anything about the history of media and political discourse in this country, here's an example. Go back. Anybody should go back and watch like presidential debates from 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Holy God. I mean, there's like nothing going on there. That was what was so thrilling about Trump and this ride. Not that I agreed with him necessarily, but I was like, Jesus Christ, they're actually debating serious ideas, fundamental ideas. That to me is the best thing about the Trump phenomenon. Even though I radically disagree with him on most of what he says, he's raising the questions and forcing the other side to actually answer them. Big questions. 40 years ago, we had 3 television networks.
Well, it was 25 years ago when I was like a kid, I was watching my first presidential debates and I got spoiled because Ross Perot was in there and he was basically saying, look, both of these guys on either side of me are full of shit. But then he was gone and that never happened again. And you're right. It became so bland and not worth watching that. And that was like the wake up for me in 2008 that like really solidified so much of my libertarian position is like the two finalists don't disagree about anything that is important to me. Foreign policy, the Federal Reserve, entitlements, none of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So Trump raised a lot of questions. I mean, just on foreign policy, which is what is making liberals' heads splatter on the sidewalk right now, is basically his ideas about foreign policy. That is what freaks them out more than anything. And that's all part of the Russia hysteria.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what do you mean of NATO? What do you mean? Of course we're going to have NATO. You don't talk about NATO. What do you mean? I mean, that just that he raised a question about whether NATO is a good thing now. That is crazy, crazy, crazy talk, people. And then, of course, well, because of that, he must be influenced by because no normal, sane person would raise that question. It must be because he's corrupted by some foreign influence.
Right.
Therefore, it must be Russia because Russia will stand to gain from the demise of NATO. Right. That's all tied together. But so that just such a fundamental question, which the Democrats and the Republicans have 100% agreed on since the founding of NATO after World War II. 100%. There's been zero disagreement about whether NATO should exist. There may have been slight disagreements about the level of funding and about whether it should march eastward, et cetera. But even on that, there wasn't any major fight. You know, when after the Cold War, when Clinton pushed NATO to go right up to the Russian borders, there were a few people in the establishment who were arguing against that and arguing against it strenuously. But do you recall that being one of the major debates of the 1990s?
No.
It wasn't a thing. It was discussed, but it wasn't like there was no fight about it.
Right.
All of a sudden, this guy with orange hair comes along and he says, wait a second, why is this a good thing for us? This makes no sense anymore. Mm-hmm. People freak out. So how do we combat that? Well, I don't know. It's just happening. And here's what we do. We embrace every technological change that allows ordinary people to speak publicly. And it's just a phenomenal, like what we're doing now as a society in that way is just unprecedented. We've never had this much diversity of opinion in public. That's the thing. I mean, there were always weirdos and iconoclasts and radicals and dissidents in America, but they didn't have access to podcasts and Twitter and Facebook and the rest of it. And old media is sinking into the sand as we speak. I mean, I used to read the New York Times cover to cover every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't do that anymore.
You don't sound like you have a great deal of concern about the noise problem that I've talked about. And I think it's a problem worth pointing out if it's going to be solved. And if people are going to get the most meaning and value out of these new channels of communication, it's kind of like we talked about on the show, the McLuhan idea. The medium is going to shape the message. So right now, people are working very hard to increase their signal to noise ratio, basically. No one's been given any training in how to do this, right? Harvard put out their fake news websites list where they don't say, here's how you – I mean, at Harvard University, an Ivy League school, it's not here's how – and I know there are courses taught there on this, but why wouldn't they make that available to the public to be a good exemplar, to say here's how we distinguish truth from bullshit. Here's how we measure journalistic standards. They just released a list of websites. Tom Woods was on it, by the way, and minimal description, one-word descriptions of why the site wound up on the list. And the descriptions were like bias or conspiracy or parody. Those were like their three categories.
Wow. I didn't know about this.
Oh, yeah.
It was the university itself or a department?
It was a department within the university and a school within Harvard that I had never heard of before. In fact, I will see if I still have the link open.
Like their communication school, maybe?
Possibly. Tom Woods sent out an email about it because he was thrilled that he had made the list.
That's amazing. He's a graduate of Harvard, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So people don't have the training. The point I was trying to make is even at the best schools – in how to become more information literate and how to defend themselves intellectually, even though most of left-wing media is making it pretty easy right now. It's like they're almost putting training wheels on the process for people, like what played out on MSNBC last week with Rachel Maddow. But people feel, and this is just from talking to people in my audience, people feel overwhelmed by, again, that horizontal, the breadth of information that comes their way every day without the opportunities to go vertically, to go deep into it and actually gain understanding. It's producing a kind of unsettled feeling, I think, in a lot of people. And people are interfacing with the world around them through headlines because the speed at which everything is coming at them is so intense.
Yeah, that impression is just the opposite of what's actually happening, though. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's just obvious to me. That there are far more ordinary, non-academic, non-specialist people
mm-hmm.
who have become essentially experts in all sorts of fields, not just politics, on their own through the internet.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. It's just they're a tiny minority of people who are using this technology. I mean, if you think about it,
I don't agree with that either. I don't think that's true either. Yeah, I mean,
okay.
So, I mean, if again, especially if you broaden it outside of politics,
mm-hmm.
There's no question. I mean, there are people. I mean, YouTube alone is allowing people to become experts in just incredible number of subjects, and then they start to teach those subjects and make money on those things, you know, with their own YouTube videos, and they're actual experts. I was sort of arguing with a feminist scholar in England the other night on Twitter about this. I mean, it's like she's talking about the neoliberal university is reducing the university to just a capitalist machine in which only the value of commodities matter, and professors are reduced to commodities and students are reduced to consumers, and therefore only things that are considered to be valuable according to the capitalist logic are allowed to be taught in universities. And I said,
what?
I said, oh, this is common. You didn't know this? We should talk about this. Oh,
yeah.
This is very common. The neoliberal university, Google that. Oh, you'll see thousands of professors making this claim.
Is this like neoliberal being used the same way that socialists were using it in the?
I would say I think it's safe to say that a majority of humanities and social science professors argue that, not just believe it, but argue that where they are working now is what they call the neoliberal university, in which capitalist logic, capitalist values have taken over, or are taking over. And I said, well, just here's one just data point. I mean, the number of gender studies majors.
Exactly. Right.
Increased by 300% in the last 20 years. So
now neoliberalism, just because I bet there's a lot of people in my audience who don't know exactly what that means. This is kind of a reference to like Chicago School economics, Milton Friedman.
Shit. Okay. Yeah. It's a big deal. It's a really big deal on the left. And I've been studying it for a while. I mean, the phenomenon of this idea of neoliberalism, it's a conspiracy theory. But it's the thing is being pervaded by, you know, our brightest minds, allegedly. So neoliberalism, okay, its original meaning and use does make sense to me, which is it was originally used to describe, as I understand it, I think this is right. The Chicago School, and in particular, the Chicago School so-called experiments in Chile under Pinochet.
The ones that sort of resurfaced during the Clinton years in Asia.
So much of Chile's economy was in the public sector when Pinochet took over after the killing of
Salvador Allende.
Allende, yeah. And Friedman and the Chicago School advised the Pinochet government to privatize much of the economy there. Now, what that meant was, in practice, as I understand it, you know, forcible privatization and really handing chunks of the economy and industries to specific business concerns, right? Which we call corporatism.
Yeah.
And then the other part of it is the IMF and the World Bank imposing, you know, giving loans to countries, third world countries, and then saying, to get this loan, you're going to have to do XYZ policy reforms. You're going to have to change your laws in all these ways to get these loans. And then if you start being delinquent on the payments for the loans, you're going to have to do more policy changes. So that's, again, corporatism. That's sort of globalist or international corporatism, right? It's essentially, you know, right.
It ends with the IMF coming in with the rake, basically.
Yeah, so forcing austerity programs, et cetera. Right. Yeah. So neoliberalism, that's how I first heard about it, used to describe that phenomenon. And that made sense to me, right? Which is that it pretends to be classically liberal and that it's bringing about privatization and market reforms, et cetera.
Exactly.
But, of course, it's at the point of a gun. It's at the point of a gun. It's, you know, it's states basically imposing these things and forcing these on the economy rather than just the state stepping back and letting people trade.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing. Like,
to me, it's corporatism. But it makes sense to call it neoliberalism because it's liberalism. It's claiming to be classically liberal, but it's not as neo and that it's not really classically liberal. So that made sense to me. Okay.
Right.
And you'll still see some people every once in a while refer to that particular phenomenon as neoliberalism, and that's fine. But everyone should Google this. It is pretty staggering. In fact, a good place to start is the place I used to work at, Barnard College. I think it's the Center for Women and Gender Research there, which I gave a talk at. I used to love those people when they just did gender stuff. They were actually really good. They still do very good work, actually. In fact, they're the ones who coined the term carceral feminism. But some people I really respect otherwise, who I actually think are very smart, people on the left in academia who I really like and I've learned a lot from, who are really good, have just fallen under the spell of neoliberalism. And it's become this term that is just applied to anything. Here it is. Anything I don't like that might have something to do with capitalism.
Absolutely. So, oh, my God. And yeah, if you can get Milton Friedman in there.
It's absolutely. So much of what they do is just completely nonsensical. A guy named David Harvey, who's
the famous British
Marxist.
Yeah, British. He's a British guy. This is how I learned about it. I think maybe, 15 years ago, 12, 15 years ago now, listening to David Harvey lectures.
So he has a lecture. He has a lecture that everybody should listen to or watch online. It's easy to find. It's a very, very famous lecture in which he lays it out. He lays out this theory that he calls neoliberalism, which had nothing to do with Chile, I don't think, or not much to do with Chile. It's a grand conspiracy theory, and it's actually centered in New York City in the 1970s and the financial collapse in New York City in the 70s and the reforms that were brought about in the 1970s, et cetera. The way he describes it, it's a conspiracy among capitalists and their friends in the government. It's phenomenal. And I didn't realize that. I didn't realize how conspiracy. I had heard about Harvey, and he's very well respected. He's probably the most respected Marxist academic in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, people, when you invoke the name David Harvey in academic circles, even if you're not a Marxist, you sort of say, oh, okay, yeah, well, he probably has a point. It's Alex Jones of the left, I swear to God. It's not really much different. It's when Glenn Beck and Alex Jones start talking about the progressive conspiracy, about which they're half right, by the way, half insane. It's the same thing. It's like David Harvey has, you know, there's some ideas in there that are right and it makes some sense, but then he just goes into this insane conspiracy theory. So it's been used to describe, to explain, not describe, to explain mass incarceration. How could that be? Who puts people in prisons? Google and Apple and General Motors?
It doesn't matter. It's like all you need is to have something called a private prison. If the concept of private prison exists, that's all. And these people hear privatization. They don't think about it as like the government taking a bunch of money from people and then giving it to their friends. They think about it being done by private companies. This was the whole Halliburton thing. This stuff from the 90s, because a lot of these guys like Harvey were critical of Clinton, you know, but this resurfaced in the Iraq War for that very reason, because people saw it as privatization. So mass incarceration, it's not a government problem. It's not a law problem. It's a private prison problem.
It's a profit problem.
A profit problem.
It's a greed problem.
Right.
Greed is at the root of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's utterly absurd in so many ways. In fact, so about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, David Simon, the creator of The Wire and Treme,
yep,
and lots of great TV shows that I love, he had to block me because I raised these questions with him. And we had about a 2-hour debate on Twitter. And then he just got so upset with me after he called me an asshole that he had to block me because he had no answers for it. But yeah, so right now, about 6%. Of prisoners in state and federal, it's only state. About 6% of prisoners in the United States are in private prisons. Okay, it's never been more than 10%. There were no private prisons before the late 1980s. Mass incarceration started in the 1970s. I mean, it's just the private prison lobby is a fraction of the size of the prison guards
yep.
unions lobbies, who in California basically run the show here. It's ridiculous.
And
anyway,
we're still using the word private to describe people who get checks cut to them from the government for housing people, yeah. Right? Okay. Go ahead.
I don't even think that that's the origin of mass incarceration. I think that's contributed to it, the prison guards unions. And sure, the private prison lobbies have contributed something to it. I'm not saying they haven't advocated for the building of prisons. But by the way, the prison guards unions are opposed to private prisons.
mm-hmm.
They're opposed. The California Prison Guards Union is opposed to private prisons because, of course, they want to control the whole thing.
Absolutely.
They're public employees. They don't want private employees competing with them. So the academic left now is explaining the growth of mass incarceration as neoliberalism, because private prisons, of course, that's neoliberal because there's a profit in there.
Yeah, exactly.
There's something private in there. And then also, but the big thing they're probably most concerned about, because this directly affects them, sort of, or at least they think it does, but it doesn't really in some way, is the neoliberal university. This is really common among academics these days. They talk about the neoliberal university. Okay, so what are the problems for them in the university now that they call neoliberal? One is, and this is true, is absolutely true, that there just are very, very few jobs for the people who have PhDs now. You know, I have suffered from this directly. I know this better than anyone. Whenever I apply for a job in academia, or when I have applied for a job in academia, about 500 people apply.
Yeah.
Right. For a U.S. history job.
Very competitive. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sometimes more. If it's a major university job, it could be close to 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's – and schools. And so that's caused this army of adjunct professors, right? People who are just free floating, who don't have a regular job, tenure track job or tenure, who will take, you know, one course here, two courses there, right? Which is what I've done for a long time. And of course, universities are happy to use that labor because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay, absolutely.
They don't pay them benefits. They get like $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 or $7,000 per course. So of course, there's been an increase in the use of adjunct labor to teach courses in colleges.
Sure.
All right. True. Absolute fact. No doubt about it. That, according to academics, is because of neoliberalism. Do they have an argument? Not really. It's just that there's a market there, and there's cheaper labor there, and there's these capitalists who actually aren't capitalists because most colleges and universities are nonprofits.
Right. Right. Right.
Who are exploiting the labor. Well, of course they're going to do that because it's cheaper. But what's the cause of this phenomenon? Why are there so few jobs, regular full-time jobs for people with PhDs? It's because a lot of us chose to get a PhD when the number of jobs were not growing as fast as the number of PhDs.
Absolutely, yeah.
When I was in graduate school in the 1990s, a long time ago, when it was just starting, we were told this. We knew this. It's not like it was a secret. We knew how many jobs there were, and we knew how many PhDs were being produced. And it's gotten even worse since then. So right. The production of PhDs is increasing, and the number of jobs is increasing, but very slowly. So it's not near. So there's just this huge. It's because we chose to do this thing, knowing full well that we were likely not to get a job. So
what did you tell yourself while you were doing it?
Is that neoliberalism? I don't think so.
No.
It's because we really wanted to teach history.
Absolutely. You talked about having this debate with a feminist on Twitter about this very issue, and you said this went on for a while. So I'm guessing you pointed out to her that, and you did mention it earlier in this conversation, that if her accusation towards higher education was that they're not teaching anything that can't be commodified, how does she explain the current state of social sciences?
Right. No, I know. Of course.
Well, what did she say?
You know, a spike in the number of departments, programs, and majors in subjects like gender studies, women's studies, ethnic studies, African-American studies, history, American studies, cultural studies, things that will get you no job, nowhere, no how.
Right.
You know, so if that's a capitalist logic, I don't know anything about capitalism.
Neither do I.
Right. So, but nonetheless, they insist. Now, there's some other evidence that they employ, like, you know, donors who are capitalists, you know, having some control over what universities do and don't do. Okay. Yeah. Every university has a board of trustees. Most of the people on those boards are capitalists. I know from my experience that they actually have very, very little, really no power, almost no power in determining curriculum. Why? Because universities have, for a century, had a system of faculty governance of curriculum, of the academic side of the house.
Yeah.
So curriculum, if an administrator or a trustee even makes a suggestion about curricular change, hell will break loose because that is the faculty's domain.
Right.
And they could break that anytime they wanted to, sure. But for whatever reason, and I think largely because they're non-profits, right, they haven't. And so faculty determine who gets hired, who gets fired, who teaches what is taught, all that. There's nothing neoliberal about it. Then again, having said all this, gosh, I can't wait for there to be neoliberal universities everywhere.
Right.
Bring it on, please. Then I get to compete with those people. I get to compete with those people on the marketplace as a teacher, as a scholar, and as a public intellectual. And the better of us will get paid and have a job. So let's please have a neoliberal university.
Was there any talk about how a bunch of government money pumped into these organizations distorts the mission or the operation of these institutions
through like the federal loans that students get, the dilution of the worth of a college degree? Any talk about that?
Yeah, they talk about that. You know what that is? It's neoliberalism, Brett. Yeah.
Well, okay. So now I'm starting to twist a little bit in my head because I'm thinking, well, if you had the state running stuff and then you had private people grabbing state money, which is what I think the critics would say about neoliberalism as it existed in Chile, existed in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
That's the phenomenon with the private prisons. So now you have all of this public money being pumped into higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Who's walking away with that money in their mind?
Well, there's two entities,
okay.
Right? So the private people, like administrators, like my girlfriend, get paid really well because of that system. And that's mostly from student loans.
You know? Right.
Most of that money is from student loans, which are backed by the federal government. So they profit, those individuals, with higher salaries. And then the other entity that profits is the federal government. So everyone should read Matt Taibbi's amazing, fabulous article on the federal loan program, student loan program in Rolling Stone about, I want to say 2 years ago. I'm not sure about that, but if you just Google Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone student loans, you'll see it's a great, great article. I mean, he's imperfect in other ways, but he's actually this is a fantastic article and he's very good on a lot of stuff. Anyway, he shows, and other people have shown this too, that the federal government, there's a surplus. They make a profit. They make more. There's a surplus from the federal student loan program. It's a quite substantial surplus. It's essentially, I guess you could call it it's just a form of taxation, really, at the end of the day. If you want to get a college education, you have to donate a bunch of your money to the federal government.
Yeah, there might be some fuzzy. I would want to look that over with some people I know who are in that business, because like I know somebody who runs a business collecting on student loans, and the stat that he gave me not too long ago was in the last 7 years, 50% of these outstanding loans have had a payment made on them.
Right.
Which is, if you think about the bubble that's to over $1 trillion that's been inflated, it's pretty scary.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly, but I have seen the numbers that Taibbi uses. The claim that there's a surplus for the federal government is not challenged. I haven't seen a challenge to that.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure how that happens, but here's one way. Here's one way. We know it happens, which is a goddamn scandal that no one talks about, which is that you cannot declare bankruptcy on student loans.
Well, I mean, from a...
You can never get off the hook for that, ever.
You can leave the country. You could die. There's two ways right there, so don't be so negative. But, here's the problem, though, and this is unfortunate, but with other types of debt, if somebody, like when this tech bubble was inflated in the 1990s, people would take money, they'd build some kind of a business where at least you had the assets of the business to take when it went belly up. The housing bubble, you had houses to take back, right? With student debt, there's nothing. You know, what are you going to do? Put the person in a coal mine or put their diploma in a crate, Indiana, end of Raiders of the Lost Ark style, and tell them they can have it back when they pay it? I mean, there's nothing to take back. There's no value there.
You can take back their credit rating.
That's it. And this is a kind of indentured servitude that is Noam Chomsky. I'm quoting Noam Chomsky here. He suggested that most people will never be able to extend themselves beyond a life of work to pay back this debt that they weren't able to properly evaluate when they signed their name to that line. And, you know, it's a tough one for me because they did sign that name and I signed my name to that line as an adult. And I still have a substantial amount of student debt. But most people, if they want the new car every 4 years, if they want the house, they are slaves. They are slaves from that point on.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that, So, I mean, it's the monopoly on education.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is federally enforced. And by the way, as I was launching Renegade University, I was looking into some people asked for college credit. Right.
This is my next question, which I could just read before you answer that. Patrick asks, I'd be interested in his thoughts on accreditation or some equivalent at Renegade.
Yeah, I would love to give college credit. In fact, my whole plan slash fantasy slash hope was to offer, you know, to start with just, you know, history credits. History, you can, so in other words, when you go to Harvard or Columbia or UC Berkeley, you can just take a course with me and have those credits counted toward your degree at those schools.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a lot of reasons, you know, one of which is that I'd have people in those classrooms who've learned from me.
Right.
Very exciting. So that would really be kind of subverting it from within. I was like, oh, dang, why would they let that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. That was my first thought.
Gee. And this is before I had researched it all the way. And I said, gosh, I bet there's some mechanism that makes that impossible. Lo and behold, I mean, you may know this. You probably do know this. I didn't actually know this. I wasn't totally sure about this. But so I did know that the accreditation system, right, is for colleges and universities is run directly, not totally. This is the key point that I didn't know about, but directly by accreditation agencies. Now, there are national accreditation agencies and there are regional accreditation agencies. The national accreditation agencies accredit the for-profit schools and I think maybe some of the religious schools as well, meaning they accredit the schools that are not prestigious.
Right.
Okay. And that's sort of the signal that's given out by that system. The regional accreditation agencies have been around since the 19th century. There are six of them arrayed across the country by region. And the progressives, here we go again. The progressives created them when all the immigrants started rushing into the United States and all these radical people were running around, and the progressives started to worry that their hallowed institutions may be sullied and tainted and corrupted and taken over and destroyed by these newcomers and weirdos and freaks. And so they established this system of accreditation where they said, this body, and they had various names for each region, will determine through careful examination that these institutions meet our standards.
Right.
And that included, you know, the number of professors with PhDs, the number of how many books were in the library, how many courses were taught in English and history and mathematics, et cetera, all these standards, right? Very high bar, in fact. But they were tailored, the standards were tailored, guess what, for the schools that already existed and had been there for decades.
Absolutely,
so,
right.
So isn't that strange, if you think about it? How many prestigious colleges and universities in the United States are less than 100 years old?
None. None.
Can't think of any. Even the New School for Social Research is 100 years old because I think it just turned 100. Isn't that strange? What other industry is that the case? What other industry is dominated by enterprises that are more than 100 years old? Like has hundreds of businesses in an industry that are more than 100 years old. How many businesses, period, in the United States are more than 100 years old? Right?
Almost none of them. I would guess less than 5% of them. I would guess less. And I would say that if you look at the Forbes top 10 as far as business profit, I bet very few of those businesses are more than 30 years old.
Right. I mean, there's certainly some, but they're not powerful. They're not dominant. All right. So that's the deal. So that's – so and one of the – by the way, one of the standards for the regional, not the National Accreditation Agency – which we all know accredits the bullshit places like University of Phoenix, so we don't take that seriously. So getting a national accreditation isn't even worth your time, really.
Right.
Except that you can get federal funds. Oh, well, I'll get to that in a second. But in terms of prestige, getting national accreditation hurts your prestige, okay? But well, there's more to that later. So among the standards for the regional accreditation agencies – which are the prestigious ones, that's how you get the name, that's how you get recognized as being a legitimate, serious institution, higher education institution. Among the standards is physical facilities. You have to have a library, you have to have a certain number of volumes of books in the library. I think you have to have a gymnasium, you have to have a certain number of courses taught in person in buildings by real professors.
Yeah.
Where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain number. Your professors have to be, I think, all PhDs or mostly PhDs or a certain very high percentage of PhDs. You have to hire and pay a large number of people with PhDs. Okay.
When was this developed? this
progressive era. 100%.
Okay, so that's interesting because that even has a leftover Prussian connection, which is where the PhD came from.
It's 100% progressive. So one of the things that progressives did was they all the American Medical Association progressivism. They imposed this system of licensing and credentialing in all the major professions to protect them from the Jews.
Right.
I'm not kidding. Like Jews and Italians and Slavs and weirdos and as I said, you know, all these people who weren't WASPs from New England with New England roots. Seriously, I mean, honestly, that's what was said, right? So that's the immediate reason why I can't get accreditation for Renegade University. No one can really, unless you have the money, theoretically, to build a campus, hire 100 PhDs, have a library, buy a million books, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
But a libertarian might say, knowing just that, well, that sucks, but there's nothing wrong with that system because these are all private institutions, these accreditation agencies, and all the colleges and universities, or many of them, are also private. So there is no grounds for complaint.
Right.
Here's the thing, which I didn't actually know until just recently when I started looking into this question. The entity that licenses the accreditation agencies.
Okay.
You cannot be a licensed official accreditation agency in higher education without the formal approval of the Secretary of Education of the government of the United States of America.
So somebody,
check this out. Hold on. It's worse. It's worse.
Okay.
So then you might say, all right, well, fine. They have their monopoly over there, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You can still just start your own university, right? And you could just say, I'm going to give credits and whoever wants to get the credits can, you know, accept them or not. Here's the deal. As we all know, as many of us know, I think as of now, every college and university in the country, pretty much, except for Hillsdale College. There may be some other exceptions, but like basically 99%+ of colleges and universities use federal student loans for much of their funding. All right. The federal government, the Department of Education, will not give federal student loans to any student attending a college or university not accredited by one of its own accreditation agencies.
Right.
It's the motherfucking mafia.
Absolutely. So
it is the mafia. So yeah, I'll go compete with all those schools who have the prestige granted by 100, 200, 300 year old monopolies, who have billions of dollars granted to them by the federal government, essentially. Sure, I'll just go compete with them.
Do you know about Praxis? Have you heard of Praxis?
I know Isaac's a good friend and he's helped me a lot. Yeah, he's great.
Oh, awesome. So, you know, so Zach was on my podcast maybe.
I know Zach too, yeah.
Yeah, 25 episodes ago. And the name of the show was Building a Better Credential. And I was reminded of this. Let me just read this. A listener named David sent this. He's kind of added this as an addendum to this accreditation question that Patrick asked. This is a point Jordan Peterson has been bringing up in interviews and other public appearances for the past few months now that the universities have lost sight of – so similar to the heterodox university message – lost sight of their authentic mission. It may be that the true university, to the extent that such a thing exists today, lives on the internet, thinking about – the mission of what a university should be. And it is only a matter of time before some clever entrepreneur cracks the code of building a new and better credential. Uh-huh. This is exactly what Zach Slabeck appears to be attempting, as discussed on School Sucks episode 454, but with an eye more toward career building as opposed to real education. Peterson seems to think it's a matter of designing the right kind of exam, something akin to maybe the bar, but measures more a broad knowledge base than just law that an individual would be able to leverage in the marketplace upon passing. I'd be interested in hearing Thad's thoughts on this.
Yeah. So that's what the for-profit colleges have been doing.
Right.
Okay. So the thing is, right, but they're not, what they're not doing is teaching history.
Right.
Right. So there's two ways to do this. I mean, it's obviously this is not eternal, although my God, it's been more than a century of this mafia system.
Right.
There's two ways to destroy it or to make it irrelevant. One is to build enough renegade universities that we have our own ecosystem, essentially, right, in which we are recognizing each other's credits, and then we become we prove ourselves in the market to be producing top-notch intellectuals, and in fact, intellectuals who are superior to Harvard's intellectuals who come out of there. And by the way, I'll do that in about 1 year.
Yeah, I agree.
Can pretty much guarantee that. Which is going to happen. That is going to happen. I am convinced that will happen. But we're going up against a Goliath, right? And it's going to take quite a while if it's just that. I mean, there's a shorter cut, which is, and I hate to be saying anything that, again, will peg me as some pro-Trump Nazi, but guess what? We have a Secretary of Education who has not said very much at all, or I think anything, about the accreditation system in higher education, but she sure has said a whole lot about privatization and right, and about school choice, and has some definite libertarian streaks in her, and understands competition, and understands what corporatist monopolies do, right? And so I think we actually might have a chance, seriously, to convince her, Betsy DeVos, to challenge the higher education accreditation system. She could pull the whole thing out tomorrow.
No,
simply tomorrow. It's her. It's entirely her deal. She has sovereignty over that. She can tomorrow say Harvard.
I know.
San Diego State. Sorry, you're going to have to compete on the open market now. All you accreditation agencies, you are fired. In fact, we're going to eliminate that part of our code. There is no such thing as federally approved and mandated accreditation. Huh.
I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Then we're living in a different world. Then we're living in a different world tomorrow.
You're absolutely right. We would be. I'm just thinking, like, when the president decides he wants to nuke something, right? There are at least a couple people who have to turn keys, right? There's some kind of failsafe. So I'm wondering what that looks like. Because you're right. You're talking about the whole system.
I mean,
it's coming down.
A congressional statute, of course, that gives the Department of Education that power, of course.
Yeah.
So it has to be an act of Congress. I mean, well, no, actually, no, I take that back. I think to remove the code, the statute that gives it that power would be an act of Congress. But I'm pretty sure, I have to check this, but I'm pretty sure the secretary decides who gets who is an accreditation agency.
Right.
So I think she could, technically, she could end the licensing of any or all of those accreditation agencies, I think, tomorrow or soon. I mean, I think. But obviously, you know, no, it's not going to happen tomorrow, even if Betsy DeVos really wants this to happen. We have to have a movement.
Yeah.
It's a movement. Okay. Now, Cato, the Cato Institute, has been all over this. And in fact, they had a whole symposium about 2 years ago on this exact subject. I think it was a day-long symposium. There's videos and you can listen to it online. It's called Higher Education Accreditation or College Accreditation in the Crosshairs. And they're all for what I'm talking about. The Heritage Foundation also is all over this too. And they've been cooperating in trying to raise some noise, but no one's listening. It's, as far as I can tell, like, no one's even aware of this except for those two. They've gotten no traction on this.
Right.
But I don't see why, especially now, my God, with people becoming aware of how fucked the higher education system is in so many ways, that this actually might be the root of all of it. I think it's the root of all of it. There's a monopoly that is economic and political, institutional, which also protects another monopoly, which we are now talking about and have been talking about for the last three episodes of this podcast, which is the intellectual monopoly, right? With tenure and faculty governance attached to, combined with this economic and political monopoly, which, by the way, the left should be totally ashamed of themselves for taking advantage of. I'm not sure they are aware of it, but But that's why they can have that intellectual monopoly.
Right.
Because they're protected by this behemoth, the federal government. So anyway, what we can do starting right now, and I mean this, everybody who's listening should at least have this on their radar, should at least be aware of it, should begin to talk about it. And it could just be with your friend. It could be on Twitter. It could be on Facebook with your dad. I don't care. Just start. That's what a movement is. You start talking about it and changing minds and just alerting people to that fact. That there's a monopoly enforced by the federal government that's basically destroyed higher education and the quality of it. And then it almost doesn't matter who the Secretary of Education is. If we have enough people talking in this way, thinking in this way and being aware of this, they'll be forced to change it.
I just always pause and think, what's the escape hatch from that for them?
There is no escape hatch if there's enough people who want it. That's the truth. That's just social. That's social change 101. It's true. I mean,
what do you think that tipping point is, or is that hard to determine before there's any kind of movement around it?
Well, if they start losing money on their federal student loan program,
yeah, sure,
that would lead to it. I think just it is happening. I think that there are people, as I'm saying, there are people. Of course, there's more unrest than ever about higher education in the system. It's just that people are unaware of the source of it.
Yeah,
even I was unaware of the full extent of it until recently. But yeah, we just got to do what you and I are doing right now, is just getting this idea out there.
Absolutely. I agree. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Yeah.
Philip asked four great questions, but I'm going to pick one.
It's interesting. We just covered one. He asked for like best practical hopes and predictions for academia. So I think we dealt with that fairly. While we were talking, another question just popped up from Leah. Has Thad heard of Praxis? So great. People are on the same page. Philip asks, if you weren't a writer and an academic, what would you have been doing for the past 20 years?
I can tell you what I wish I were doing.
Sure. Yeah.
Being a boxing coach.
Really? Why?
Well, I've always loved to teach. I've always been very good at it. And that was actually why I became an academic, not so much because of the scholarship, although I came to love scholarship too, but I really originally just wanted to be a teacher, a college teacher, because I love teaching. So there's that. It's teaching. It's the kind of teaching I love, actually. I love being coached. I had never been coached, having been in a socialist hippie family and city as a kid. So I was never like in Little League or any of that. I never had a coach.
Right.
I was afraid of that whole world. I thought it was like really macho and masculine and like the military and bad. And that's how everybody in Berkeley thought of that, right? That's what that's what Trump voters do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People like that, right? That's a Republican thing to do. So then in my early 40s, I started taking boxing lessons and classes, and which is coaching, which is this thing where you like for that hour you submit, not permanently submit, but for the hour you submit to this person and you do what he says. And now that only works if the person knows what they're talking about and you respect them. Mm-hmm. But I did in this case, because I knew zero about boxing at the time. And these were like professional boxers. So, hey, and I loved it. I just loved it. I loved that feeling. And I also love getting out of my head.
Yeah.
Because I'm in my head all the time.
Sure. Sure.
And I kind of just, and I've always been into sports. And so I found the sport that I was good at, and it was thrilling to me. And I also found that I studied it because I am an intellectual. Hey, so I started not just taking the classes, but like watching boxing and kickboxing and MMA and like studying it. It's funny. My coach last night just said something. He said, man, you're really obsessed with technique, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And it's true. I love that part of it as well. And so when I've started to coach a little bit, and I just love it. It's just too fun. It's just so much fun. And it's like using my intellect and my mind, but in a way that is also, the other thing I love about it is that there's no conflict with other people. It's funny to say that because you're hitting people in the face, but like after you spar someone and hit them in the face and they hit you in the face, most of the time you hug them.
Mm-hmm.
This is an amazing moment, right?
Yeah.
But most importantly, there's just not, you know, because there's this relationship established between the coach and the athlete, there isn't usually a conflict, right? The sensei, whatever relationship. And for that, again, as a society, that would be a dictatorship, and I'm not for that. But, you know, in that moment, it's like this wonderful respite from my world, which is living in my head, and fighting with people constantly about ideas, which is what I love still. And I do it and I won't give it up. But man, it is, it's like going to church for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just, yeah. So
do you think you'd want to do it with kids? You think you'd want to do it with like teach kids? I think like there's a real need for that today. You know, even like when I started working with kids in the year 2000, we take them skiing and we take them kayaking, you know?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think is a problem that really shows up in a higher education environments today, or just maybe with that generation generally, is they haven't done enough losing. You know, they haven't done enough failing. And
that's my son's problem.
Yeah, we would take these kids out. We would say, okay, tough guy, take on Mother Nature, you know, and they would learn, and they would learn some humility, because a lot of these kids, they come from like inner city Providence or Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and, you know, they were the baddest motherfucker you'd ever seen, because there was no one there from their neighborhood to back that up, so they could say whatever they want. So we'd go out and we'd throw them in a river, and they weren't the baddest motherfucker we'd ever seen. And, you know, so it was an educational and kind of a humbling experience for them. And it was a growth experience. And I think that martial arts provides the same thing.
Yeah. If you've ever hung out with fighters, like professional fighters, one of the things that's most striking is that they're the opposite of what you'd expect them to be like in person. In the ring, they may do the whole macho performance thing, sure. But like in person, I've never met a professional fighter or a serious amateur fighter who wasn't just the most mellow, relaxed, humble, kind person. I mean, there really are. I mean, I think because they get out the aggression in the sport, but also I think what you're getting at, which is that you're humbled immediately.
Yeah.
You're humbled immediately in that sport, even when you're great. I mean, my original coach gets knocked out like once every 2 years on camera, on TV, on national TV. And it's like, there's nothing more humbling than that, you know, being knocked out cold. So,
And not that there's anything particularly virtuous about humility. It's that you're able to deal with adversity with dignity, you know?
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, right. I don't want to be a Puritan. So Puritans say humility in itself is a good thing, is a virtue. No, right.
Right. No. Right.
And Buddhists do too. I'm not into that. No, exactly. It's a great means to success on your own terms. Right.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd love to work with kids, and I have been working with some kids in boxing, and actually a couple of, one guy who's, wants to be an amateur fighter. So he's further along, but I love both. It's great. Yeah. So that's what I would do. Totally, totally different than what I'm doing now.
Awesome. So whole speed round worth of questions we didn't get to, but we could probably do that at some point in the future. We'll be announcing some big things, soon related to a joint event we're going to do this summer. But if people are excited by that possibility, excited, especially people in New England, an opportunity to attend such an event, go to ThaddeusRussell.com and get on his mailing list.
Just so you know, not you, Brett, but people listening, the event you're referring to is not on the site yet, but it will be. But if you get on the mailing list, you will find out when it is announced.
Awesome. All right, everyone. Let's talk just a little bit about that before we end the show today. At this point, Thaddeus and I have confirmed that we are going to be doing a joint event. Renegade University and School Sucks Project present Thaddeus Russell. The event is going to be held in the greater Boston area on August 5th and August 6th. And we might even do a little getting to know you thing on August 4th. We're not sure yet. He and I have been in touch almost every day planning this event. There is a extremely high level of enthusiasm about this. We're bouncing around all kinds of ideas. Right now, we're trying to shape the event itself. So we're juggling 3 or 4 different topics for the weekend. And we are also surveying venues, many venues. Harvard, these fucks, they wanted $10,000 to hold an event at their science center. It was required to have bathroom attendants and pay them $65 an hour for a minimum of 4 hours. So just imagine, there were many charges that we saw as superfluous. So Harvard, unfortunately, is out, even though that would have been the number one spot from the belly of the beast, so to speak. So August 5th and 6th, Greater Boston area, Renegade University and School Sucks Project present. This is what is known so far.
We're hoping to get these details finalized next week and put the tickets on sale. But if you are interested in this event, please go to ThaddeusRussell.com and jump on his mailing list. If you are on my mailing list, which you can join right at the top of SchoolSucksProject.com, you will also be informed when we finalize things. I'm super excited about this. It is going to be an intimate event. We're talking maybe 50 people. There'll be a regular ticket and a VIP ticket. And I really want to be able to offer a number of spots to people from my audience, because Thaddeus is going on the Joe Rogan Show about, I think, 1 month from today, and he's going to promote the event there, and after that, it is surely going to be sold out. You got to figure Joe Rogan has at least 10, 15, 20,000 listeners in that area. So I'm really hoping by the end of the first week of April, we'll have everything set up so we can start bringing people in from the School Sucks audience first, and I really look forward to seeing you at this event. All right, everyone, that's it for today. Thank you for listening to this series. I hope you enjoyed it. And I will be back again very soon with something entirely different. Take care. Thank the day when that primitive man learned to talk with his brothers and live off the land. He left his cave and he moved far away, and he lived with his friends in a house that they made. He learned to think and to work with his brain, and he astounded his friends with all the knowledge he gained. Showed all his friends and they passed it around, and then education came that day. The day it came was the same day. Education came that day. We thank God for the friends he made. Inventors with their high IQ, and the professors in their colleges trying to feed me knowledge that I know I never use. Thank you, sir, for the millions of words that you handed me down and you told me to learn. And I got words in my ears and my eyes. I got so many facts that I must memorize. Sacred.